So welcome, my name is Sharon and I serve the village's education coordinator and it's my pleasure to introduce Steve Holland from Lakeview College, graduate of St. Olaf's, correct?
Correct.
Got to get that in, right? And he's going to give a series of three sessions on morality and economic life, and today we're looking at markets and inequality. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks. Thanks everyone for coming. It's been my experience over the years, and we're going to sit around and talk about economics is the best way to draw a crowd, so I the plan today, I think we're scheduled for an hour and a half. I don't really plan on going that long. In my experience, that's too much time to talk about economics, but we'll go for a while, and then we'll get you to lunch. I'm going to start out by talking a little bit, kind of laying the foundation, letting you know how I came about thinking about these things, and then we'll get at it after that. I know I want this to be fairly interactive. I am an economist, but I am not a moral philosopher, and so I'm trying to tie those two things together. I'm outside my comfort zone, and so that, I thought this was a perfect place to do that. I've been teaching economics for 15 years or so, and in my experience, as I teach out of the textbook, my students are really more interested in sort of how does this affect my life, because how do things we're learning about really, do they make our lives better or worse? We live in the United States, and in most places actually, we live in a capitalist economy. But there's a lot of disagreement, and there has been for centuries, about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? You go back to Marx, and he said that this capitalism is not good for workers, and it contains the seeds of self-destruction. You go up through Occupy Wall Street. There's a lot of criticism about our economic system, and is it really a good thing or a bad thing? On the other hand, there are really persuasive arguments, I think, that capitalism has led to economic growth, and it has pulled probably billions of people out of poverty. Poverty is one of the great, or one of the most awful things of our time, right? And sort of economic growth is good for this. So is it good or bad? It's kind of the question I'm interested in exploring. On a day-to-day basis, I think we ask ourselves these questions. Inequality, which is the topic today, I think has been in the news a lot lately. You see growing inequality in the United States, and there's a lot of concern about that. Well, today I want to think a little bit about, how bad is that, what's causing it, what can we do about it, kinds of things. Tomorrow we'll do a session on the environment, which is another sort of negative byproduct of economic growth. And then on Friday, I want to spend a little time talking about capitalist systems and community. How does this market system affect community, family, culture, that kind of thing? There's a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt. I don't know if any of you have read some of this stuff. He's got a book out called The Righteous Mind, which I highly recommend. But he in some of his other works, has talks about sort of three stories of capitalism. One is that capitalist systems lead to exploitation, right? The owners exploit the workers, the corporations exploit everybody, rich countries exploit poor countries. That's one story we get of the system. Yet another story of capitalism is that what it does is it creates opportunity, right? That we can take our skills and our talents and we can trade them with other people. It leads to growth, it leads to wealth, it pulls people out of poverty, right? The great American dream is somehow founded on some of these ideas, right? And so the third story of capitalism, and this is the one I really sort of want to push a little bit, is a more nuanced one, right? I don't think either of those first two versions of capitalism are fully correct. There are some truth in both of them, right? But the middle, the gray area in the middle, is sort of the interesting part. It recognizes that capitalism is both good and bad, and what we really ought to be asking is, I've set this sort of session up by asking, are capitalist economies, do they help or hinder our quest for a better life? I did that just to sort of grab your attention, but that's really not the right question. The question is not whether capitalism is good or bad, the question is, under what circumstances does it work? Under what circumstances doesn't it work? And how can we sort of guide it and shape it to make it better for what we want to accomplish, right? And so that's kind of what I want to dig into over the next three sessions and think about those things a little bit. All right. So I've been throwing around the word capitalism, but we should probably talk about what that is. What is capitalism? I'm going to teacher mode now. I know you didn't have pre-assigned reading. So when I say capitalism, what do you think?
Free market.
Okay, good. Free markets, what else?
Profit and loss.
Okay, good. Other things?
The primacy of return on capital over anything else.
Okay. This is sort of related to profit and loss, slightly different.
No, different. The primacy of capital, return on capital.
Return on capital.
Over anything else.
Okay, gotcha. Prioritizing return on capital. Word capitalism, right? It implies that we have to think a little bit about
maximizing your personal benefit.
Okay.
You're looking for yourself, number one.
Okay, good. So there's an element, how many people, is there an element of selfishness that capitalism connotes?
Yeah,
some people. Well, when economists think about capitalism, we don't think about a single thing. There is not a single capitalism, right? There are an infinite number of flavors of capitalism. And the way I think about it is that there are all these institutions, economic, political, social institutions that sort of come together and form our economic systems, right? Capitalism usually focuses on sort of three of these institutions, but it's not just three. So one, and you hit on most of them. The first one, which I don't think anyone mentioned, is private property. We own stuff. We own our own stuff, right? That's probably the big one. The second one is markets. And that we're able to exchange. And then the third one, which is a little more complicated and gets at the issues of capital, is that production occurs, and this is getting a little wonky, but production occurs in firms, that you own capital, you create things, and there's an individual profit motive that underlies that. So, you know, you think about something like, a controlled economy, like the former Soviet Union, that, a lot of those institutions didn't exist, particularly the one about private production, right? When the government is guiding how much we produce and when we produce it, that is not capitalism. Okay, so in the United States, it's private property markets and then private production. But there's a lot more that goes into it besides those things. So there are all sorts of laws, right? We have laws about environmental regulations, health and safety regulations. We have intellectual property laws. We have all sorts of laws that sort of shape how we produce, how we exchange, and those sorts of things. We have lots of social norms, right, about how we interact with each other. When you go to the store and you give them some money, they give you a pack of gum or whatever you buy. There are all sorts of sort of unwritten rules that go into that make these things work, right? And different cultures and different social norms lead to a different sort of capitalism. So it's a collection of all these institutions, and I guess the reason I bring this up is because what I want to kind of urge you to think about is, can we change these institutions? Can we redefine these institutions? Can we sort of mix them together in different ways to serve our needs better than we maybe currently are? Right? There's a professor at St. John's in Minnesota, a guy named Dan Finn, who's written about this a little bit, and he calls this the moral ecology of markets. So he sort of talks about this set of institutions like an ecological system where all these things are working together to create, all these different pieces are working together to create a sort of a whole, right? They interact with each other. Well, can we change the nature of those institutions? Can we change that ecological system so that it works better? So that's my goal. That's what I want to do. So let's get at it. I want to talk about inequality today. I was Googling this before I came to home. So I was like, oh, okay, you know, let's, you know, I was looking for sort of a typical person. So I ran into two stories, both in the last couple of weeks, about different workers. And so I'm going to just summarize them. The first was a story about tech workers in Seattle. Probably a lot of people here from Seattle live near Seattle. So this was a story about it was a male, fairly young, a guy in his 30s, had a graduate degree in computer science, had a series of jobs in various tech companies. He had just moved to Seattle from San Francisco to avoid the high cost of living in San Francisco. Why did he go to Seattle? I don't know. His annual salary was about $200,000. He had been moving jobs fairly frequently, it sounded like. You know, this is very common in the tech industry. You work for a company, you're always looking for a bigger and better deal. Maybe the company doesn't do what it's supposed to do, or it fails, and they move on. Okay. And he was, and so in the story, it was sort of talking about him and you know, his complaints, well, you know, the high cost of living killing me, the commute's killing me, life is rough. Right? So this is one person. The other story I ran into was about a female factory worker in Reading, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. She's got a high school degree. She had just been laid off from her job at a paper mill in Reading, Pennsylvania. Before she got laid off, she was making $22 an hour, which probably was between $40,000 and $50,000 a year, I think. So her sort of history is that she would get a job in a factory. She'd work there for decades, perhaps, and then the factory would close, and she struggled for years. She'd find a job in another factory. She'd work there for a while, then close. And this was sort of her work history. Okay. Her problems, her complaints, was a lack of steady work, really odd shifts oftentimes, you take the jobs you can get. And she was talking about how it took a toll on her sort of physical condition. The title of the story was I love my manufacturing job, but I don't want my kids to do it. Mm-hmm. And so sort of talking about that. Okay, so think about those two people. And I want to use that to sort of frame up the discussion a little bit. So I think the first thing we have to do if we're talking about inequality is sort of think about what sort of inequality we're talking about. Right? Their lives are very different. Okay? And all of our lives are different. That's just the nature of life. Right? But when we talk about equality or inequality, the first thing we have to ask is, well, when we're measuring inequality, what is the metric we're using? You know, inequality of what? So what's the relevant measure of inequality here? If we're comparing these two people, what are the important criteria we should be using to evaluate equality and inequality?
Salary, benefits, quality of life.
Okay, so a couple of things in there, right? So one would be income. That's a very common way. That's one of the main ways that economists measure inequality is through income. Quality of life, what do you mean by that?
Vacation, sick leave, maternity support.
Okay, good. So the sort of elements of work-life balance that come with that. So, okay.
Job safety.
Safety? Yeah, and if you're working in the factory, that could be a significant thing.
Health insurance.
Okay. Health insurance, okay. Health. I mean, are we healthy? That's another. Another important criteria, right?
Retirement plans.
What's that?
Retirement plans.
Okay, retirement plans, so sort of security over the course of your life.
About education, foundational part of their life, as far as education.
Okay, education, so we can compare their educational level and say, you know, is this equal? So, that is actually something I think I want to get into a little bit later.
In all of that, though, we're making some value judgments.
We're making lots of value judgments, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think of this lovely person at McDonald's that I see in Iowa, and I don't know her, but if I did, I have a hunch that she would speak about her quality of life, and I would be judgmental about that. Mm-hmm. What kind of job is that?
Yeah.
It's a tough thing.
It's really tough. I mean, just because we wouldn't necessarily choose it doesn't mean it's a bad thing, right? And so some of these, this is kind of what I'm trying to get at, right? Some of these criteria we use to compare people, we have to be really careful about the criteria we use. Are there other thoughts?
Competence, economic certainty, or reliability, and then mobility. those two people have significantly different mobile.
They have, so one, okay, this is good. So one person might have more choice, more opportunity than the other. That's another way to measure inequality. I mean, we have equal opportunity.
Job security.
Job security. Or the flip side of that is job risk, right? Like how risky is my situation compared to your situation? Okay. These are all good ways to think about that. What about happiness? I thought someone might just throw that out. Is that a good way to compare?
Yes.
Is there comparing, you know, we're talking about inequality and quality of happiness?
Sure. Surveys do that all the time.
Yeah. Satisfaction, well-being, happiness.
Lack of anxiety.
Yeah.
Stress.
Stress. Yeah. It's good.
Do they feel like what they're doing is worthwhile?
Yeah. Okay. Good. Sort of a
for the greater good.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the word on
this?
A sense of purpose, life satisfaction. And the word that keeps popping into my mind, which is not exactly what you're referring to, but you know, are we flourishing in a way that it is both personal, but also as a part of our community? Are we doing those things?
Societal contribution.
Yeah. What is my role in the greater good?
The problem is, though, is that it's just not our values. So, I mean, I can say I'm doing all that, but I'm a ELCA pastor and I make $50,000 a year and I can hardly make, you know, I mean, so the world around me, I couldn't live in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So the problem is it's not just our value system, but there's imposed value systems on us. Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. And I think that's one of the things we have to be careful about. Well, let's go at it this way. So, I mean, there are lots of ways to measure inequality. Economists tend to look at income and wealth, not necessarily because that's what matters, but because it's the easiest thing to measure, right? And so, you know, yeah, you're laughing. You know, we get laughed at a lot. But I mean, there's a little bit of logic to that, right? If income is a proxy for some of these other things, or if it's correlated with some of these other things you're talking about, but if you're wealthier, you're likely to be healthier. If you're wealthier, you're likely to have more opportunity. If you're wealthier, you know, you're not necessarily, doesn't necessarily imply you're going to be able to contribute to the greater good, but perhaps you are, right? And if you have those sorts of resources, then you might be able to do things. So that's what we use, but it's not the best way to do it. And we have to be very careful and recognize that it is only it's a proxy. It stands in for the things that we really care about. And what we really care about is open to much debate, right? So I think we have to keep that in the back of our mind. And happiness is one that we often think about. There's an economist and philosopher guy named Amartya Sen who talks, he and Martha Nussbaum and some other philosophers talk a lot about capabilities. We should be aiming for equality in capabilities. It sort of gets at that opportunity thing. So if, you know, if there are fundamental capabilities and we all have those capabilities, then how we choose to use them is sort of up to the individual. But if you don't have those capabilities, then your choice set is limited, and that seems unfair to us somehow, right? So there are lots of different ways to think about inequality and how we measure inequality, but making those comparisons is really, really difficult. I've sort of gotten into this a little bit. Why do we care about inequality? I should probably ask that. So sort of going on the assumption that you care or that we should care. Why do we care? Why should we care? Why does it really matter? You know, we're all different, right? Why should we even care that there's some amount of inequality? We seem to. Why?
Well, that's what God wants us to do. God wants us to do that, to care.
Okay.
There's such a sense of fairness about it. You know, I mean, it's unfair that some people are better off in so many ways than others. So there's a fairness issue.
Yeah. Is that kind of what you were getting at?
It's
I mean, we should care about others, but But why should we care in a way that that makes us equal? I mean, I can care about someone who's very unequal, you know, just as much. You know, why is equality? I'm not saying this very well, but why is it one of our goals as we care for others? What, you know, why is equality something that's important?
Are you talking about equality or equity? Because equality means that we all have exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't have 20/20 vision, so does that mean I'm not equal to you because you do? But if you give me glasses so that I can see 20/20, now we have equity. Yeah. So I think it's more about that. I don't think we all should be exactly the same. I don't think anybody would say that. But but equity is about equal access to resources and to the services and resources and things that make life good in our community. So I would more vote for equity than equality.
Yeah, or some sort of equivalence sometimes is talked about that way. Yeah.
Or to put it in a slightly different way, are we talking about inequality of, so we say, outcome or of opportunity?
Yeah, that's a good problems. Question. There's sort of this idea of sort of a substantive equality, you know, some outcome-based measure of equality, or is it more procedural? Is it, you know, are we trying to create the same opportunities or the same, you know, the same sort of freedom, maybe? To make those choices. But these all seem to be grounded, everything you say seems to be grounded in some idea of fairness, the way that this innate sense of fairness.
Yeah, sort of going away from fairness, I'm a great disciple of Nick Conower, who is a venture capitalist out of Seattle. He says wealthy people don't spend as much money on basic needs and stuff. If more poor people had more money as opposed to rich people having money, they'd buy more product from me as a manufacturer, me as a store owner or whatever. I myself would be better off economically if my neighbors had more money to spend to buy my product. If I've got all the money and they don't, they're not buying my product, I'm worse off. Yeah. So from a very selfish motive, the better my neighbors are, the better I am.
That's a really interesting point, right? And so let me frame up. There are two sides to this debate, right? One argument you hear is that trying to create greater equality, maybe through redistribution from the rich to the poor, higher tax the rich more, you know, give that money in some form to the poor. The one argument is, well, that's really bad, because what it does is it reduces incentives for the rich to produce and create, and it's actually going to harm economic growth, right? The other side of that argument is the one that you just made, that no, in fact, equality is better for economic activity, economic growth, because poor people have more opportunity, they're going to be able to work more, and all those sorts of things. Which one do you think is true? I kind of know the answer, I think, but what do you think? Yeah.
I think equality is important for the stability of the society and economic situation, because when you have large disparity, it creates more volatile situations, leads to war, conflict, and that situation. So just for the stability of the system, equality is probably good.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I don't know if everybody heard that, but you talked about, you know, greater equality leads to a more stable system. There are a lot of ways to think about that. There's something to that. There's quite a bit of evidence, actually, that with greater equality, there's more trust and cooperation within a society, which actually makes things both economically and politically and culturally sort of run a little bit better. And as inequality grows, that you get exactly the thing you're describing, you know, some instability, which sort of gums up the system a little bit so that things don't work quite as well.
Well, from a selfish standpoint, if you wanted to live in a society that had greater equity and access to resources for everybody, in the event that your business takes a downturn and then you're on the flip side of the coin, you want to be in a society where you have those chances to thrive again.
Yeah, I think that's a really big point.
I wonder, though, if we should back up a little bit to say, okay, economic inequality is bad, but then you have to ask, what is your ethical framework from asking that question? Do you believe that there is scarcity and there's only so much, and so equality means I have to have less for others to have more?
Yeah.
Or is it scarce to say an ethic of abundance, which is there is more, there is enough for everybody,
yeah,
and there's actually more than enough for everybody if we just use our resources better. So I worry that, like, you know, in this room you might say economic inequality, we all know what we're talking about. But in, you know, Appalachia, we're saying economic inequality, and they're thinking a different thing.
Yeah.
There's only so much coal in the mountain. There's only so much copper in the mountain.
Yeah. I think that's a really, really good point. And so this, you know, some of these ideas get at, this is not a zero-sum game necessarily, right?
And so some people view it that way.
Yeah, right. So they're really interesting arguments that equality actually sort of helps us get around that zero-sum game problem if we work together a little bit better. Yeah.
There are three items that that people have problems controlling, and that's the price of housing, that's the price of transportation, and the price of medicine. Mm-hmm. And if you can get that price of housing down, where I designed a house 40 years ago that had 211 square feet in the house, 211 square feet. If you can just imagine yourself living in a pod, maybe a pen, with 211 square feet, but this is what it's going to come down to. The race right now in Seattle is how much square footage am I going to get for $500,000? And we're not going to get anything. We're going to have to find a teardown to survive there. And as far as transportation is concerned, you have to buy the ugliest car in order to not want to drive the car, so your transportation costs are as low as possible because you don't want to get in that car only when you have to drive that car, not because you want to show it off. And as far as medical, you want to keep your costs down and join some kind of a group that keeps you as healthy as possible. Mm-hmm. It's tough. It's tough. You know, people are very greedy. They're greedy people, you know? And they don't want to give up their things. That's it.
The issue of equality and equity and certain things that technology has led us to. We have medicine that can stop some travails of existence. We have, you know, ways to put shelter over us so we can live in different environments and can still exist. But so those lower thresholds of what we find acceptable keep rising as our technological capabilities keep improving. But then on the other end of the scale, we basically have envy, where somebody is ultra rich and somebody is modestly endowed economically, but still don't have any risk of homelessness or medical adversity, but they still don't have a yacht, they still don't have a Mercedes, they still don't have, you know, so then they somehow get the idea that that's what they want, that if they don't have that, they're unequal or there's an inequity.
This is a great segue. You're actually using some of the language that I sort of talking about. So, I mean, you probably noticed the long on questions and short on answers, but that's the way this kind of necessarily has to be, right? So, you know, I mean, but we do, I think, have to think hard about, you know, what sort of equality are we talking about and why we care about it. But I want to get into a little bit more economics, actually, if you don't mind, about, you know, why. Like, how did these inequalities form? So, you know, I do want to tie it into this question of capital a bit. And sort of at the heart of this is there something inside a capitalist system that necessarily is going to lead to greater inequality, or is it the result of some choice? Is it political? Is it racism? Is it some sort of oppression? You know, what is the cause of it?
Yes.
And if there's something in that baked into capitalism that leads to greater inequality, that it's important to know that. So, and again, I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know the answer exactly, but I do have some ideas. You mentioned technology, and I think, you know, one of the reasons I chose these two examples of the tech worker and the manufacturing worker is because I think that there is something about technology that's going on here, right? So let me set it up that way and see if we can get some discussion going. I wonder if this thing works. Hey, okay, so I'm not going to draw much, but there's a very simple way that economists sort of think about people and how they gain income, right? So we think you use the word endowment, and that's exactly the word I was thinking of.
I could if it was a longer period.
Economists think about people having certain endowments of things, and our language is kind of technical and a little crass and cold and not very personal, so you just have to roll with me. But people have endowments of various things, and economists think of endowments of labor. We all have our time and our ability to labor, right? Where does that come from? I mean, obviously, people only have 24 hours a day, but the quality of our labor, the nature of our labor, what you're able to do, what I'm able to do, are different. Where does that come from? Where do we get those skills?
Education.
Piece of it.
Health.
Location.
Yep, exactly. Good.
Genetics,
part of it. Yeah. Might be some innate talents or intelligence or skills.
Family history. Passed down.
Exactly.
The ambition of society to receive our work, our efforts.
Yeah. Okay,
bias and prejudice.
Okay. Good. Good. So that's like two things. That's what I'm going to get into. Is like our, you know, how does society receive it? Is, I think, is really important. But
yeah.
But here is another issue. I mean, you know, the value of our labor could be the result of things like our race and our gender, our citizenship, right?
Yeah.
I mean, my ability to labor in the United States is much greater than some of my international students who really struggle, right? That's just an accident of birth, right? And so all those things all go into this. You know, there's skill, there may be innate skills, there may be training, there may be just accidents of birth that lead to that. The other thing, getting to capital, is the other thing we're endowed with. So we own stuff, you know, we might own land, you might own stock in a corporation, you might own some equipment, you might own some tools that help you create things, right? And so what we do is we put these things together, we take these endowments, the stuff that we have, the skills and the things we have, and we exchange them with the rest of the world, and we get income out the other side, right? So once in it, so if we're thinking about income as a measure of inequality, or the proxy for the things you really care about, then this is a useful way of thinking about it, right? And what I want to kind of focus on is what goes on here. So, you know, we're not all the same here, and this comes about in different ways, but our ability to exchange it with the rest of the world is affected by lots of things. Our institutions, capitalism, right? The markets, how they work. Some of what goes into that is policy. We have laws and rules that say how we can exchange things with each other, minimum wage laws, health and safety laws, whatever. But I think technology is also really important. And that's where I want to spend a little time right now. So, you know, the two people I was telling you about a little while ago, their lives are very different, and I think technology is kind of important to that. Let's think about that a little bit. So technological change is something economists think a lot about, right? And there's a lot of concern that that is one of the causes of greater inequality. So I just kind of want to think that through a little bit better. So maybe sort of as a baseline, maybe this is obvious, maybe it's not, but technological change has been a part of our lives for hundreds, thousands of years. Well, why? Why do we want new technology?
We want to make our lives easier.
Okay, so one is that it may make things easier. Yeah. I mean, if you invented a new technology that didn't make your life easier, you would think you wouldn't want it. I think there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, but at least you could.
Time saving.
Yeah, maybe time, you know, or you think it's going to save time.
Efficiency.
Efficiency in what sense?
Well, it's interesting to me that we haven't talked about it. It's one of the sort of inherent moral values that's part of economic theory that is portrayed as a non-moral value. So when I think of issues of sort of how we get to the point where we are able to exchange it, so much of the output of technology is trying to make the corporate structure more efficient, or our labor more efficient, or our life more efficient.
So by efficiency, you mean we're sort of getting more stuff with less time,
like
less effort,
input,
less money.
Right. Yeah. Consequences of what we're doing take less work.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
I think that you almost have to qualify technology. There's the there's a push often to just create new technologies because it keeps the market going and it keeps people spending money and buying things and feeling like they need more stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the kind of technology that's going to, in the long term, make people smarter and make people more efficient and create better markets. So,
yeah.
So that this idea that technology is always going to get us through to a better end, I think, is creating a lot of problems and a lot of contributing to a lot of the inequalities right now.
Yeah. I agree. This is actually what you're talking about. Is maybe something that will come up tomorrow when we talk about the environment. But I think you know this idea that we can solve our problems through technology is a really fascinating one. But, yeah.
I wrestle with technology in my own personal life. In medicine, statins. I could use a statin, you know, which is technology, which is great, you know, as an excuse for poor body stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could go in a lot of different ways with technology, where I can maintain my status quo as far as stewardship, not have to deal with it, because hopefully this new technological invention or advancement can relieve me of that, at least temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Sustainability. Like with solar panels now, the technology, and that's the fastest growing job market in the country, and it's for the purpose of environmental health.
Yeah, I was talking with someone at breakfast this morning in the solar industry, and actually it gets to efficiency. The cost of creating solar under many circumstances is not cheaper than creating energy through coal and other things. So it does get at that question of efficiency. Economists refer to this process of this drive for greater efficiency, that innovation for greater efficiency is creative destruction. In fact, I love that term because you create a new thing, but in the process of creating something better, you're destroying the thing that you're replacing. Right, and I think you see that when you think about the two workers we're talking about, there's new technology all the time. The U.S. has become a service and a high-tech country, but as a result, it's destroyed a lot of manufacturing jobs. Right, it's that idea of creative destruction and there's something in that idea that seems to be affecting the growing inequality. I want to think about that a little more. Yeah.
The comment about stewardship is really interesting. I think about spending time in Cuba and seeing billboards all over about, you know, pick up trash or drink water or things about messages coming from the government about how to take care of oneself. And I would think one thing to improve people's lives in the capitalist system would be public messages to have better stewardship so people have more of the things we're talking about, you know, health, safety, efficiency, quality of life. But if you have a system that the incentives are there to actually make people sick so that money can be made in trying to make them well, you're not going to necessarily have those messages promoted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that, you know, that's an example of why I think it's really important to ask, you know, are these things, is the problem systemic? Is there something baked into the system that forces to happen, or is it in some way a choice, a policy choice? Yeah.
I think one important aspect of technology or characteristic of technology is that all technology in some way extends human capability. So you're using a microphone right now to extend the projection of your voice. We use cars and airplanes to extend the ability of humans to go, how far they can go, how fast they can go. We use computers to extend the capacity of our to assist our brains in processing information.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that any of that is good or bad. It just is, and we're continuously coming up with new technologies in order to extend our capabilities.
Well, I want to twist that. There's a lot of hands there. I want to try to get through as many of us can. But I mean, this is interesting, and it's something I wanted to talk about, so I'm going to take this opportunity to ask that question, you know, is it good or bad? So, you know, if you think about the two people that I've t- talked about tech worker and manufacturing worker seems to be good for one and bad for the other. So, well, why is that?
The person that is making the $200,000 a year, he's got a big table of technology, okay? The person that's making the $35,000 a year, he has small technology, okay? I can go out and build a house out of things that I pick up at a garage sale. If you think small and you think simple, okay? So this guy that's making that $200,000 a year, he's way over the head of anybody that's making this $40,000. Is he any better off? Not in the least bit is he better off. Not in the least bit. He thinks he's better off, but he's not. He's got more ulcer problems. He's got more problems. He's nervous.
That is speculation, of course. I do know rich people who are happy. they exist. There are probably some in this room. So. But why does the technology affect these two people so differently?
Access. And they have different levels of access to it.
Yeah, that could be part of it.
Also, technology and labor, the day labor is taking her job away from her.
Yeah.
Because of automation and robots.
Right.
But for the tech worker, you know, you need the people to program those robots. So for him, it's the technology.
Yeah. So this is to use some more economic jargon. We often think this is really crass, but we think of people as being substitutes or complements for technology, right? And the tech worker, technology is a complement to their skills, right? But the manufacturing worker, the technology is the substitute for their skills. It takes their jobs, right? Okay, we can't get through an hour with an economist without at least one graph. I'll make it small, but this is really interesting. So on this axis is hourly wage. So, you know, low wage, high wage. And on this graph is the number of new jobs expected over the next decade. What do you think that graph looks like? So this is lots of new jobs, this is few new jobs, this is high wage, this is low wage.
Downward slope.
Now, part of it's downward slope. Actually, it looks like this. It's really interesting. So what you see up here, very high wage people who tend to, their skills tend to complement technology, right? The people in the middle, these are manufacturing workers and sort of what we consider blue collar. That's not a great term, but you know, that idea. Their skills or technology is a substitute for their skills. The people down here, it's kind of neither. So they tend to be service industry people, restaurant workers, you know, home healthcare workers, daycare workers, things like that, where technology is really less relevant to their jobs, but they tend to be low-paying jobs. So these things, I think it's fascinating. But when you think about that, so what's that going to do? If this is true, you're going to have a lot of new low-paying jobs, a lot of new high-paying jobs, and the middle's going away. What's going to happen to inequality?
Rich get richer?
Or exactly.
Extreme. Middle class.
Yeah. Right. I think it's just fascinating. Yeah.
In terms of our need to understand technology, most of us in here can see, most of us can smell, most of us can hear, most of us can taste, but not any of us can sense the electronics that are around us. I mean, the room is full of all sorts of energy that we have no idea is in here except by using our technology to detect it. So radio waves, you know, so things that are here that are physically existing, that we don't have a concept that they exist except by our understanding of technology. makes those people that can sense those things, it gives them a fifth sense or a sixth sense of what's really happening in the physical environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's advantageous to making other things happen or reacting, protecting ourselves from other things.
I have a problem with this graph because it doesn't tell the full story.
No, of course not. Two dimensions, right?
Yeah. But the important full story about inequality, which maybe you're going to go to, which is all those workers combined, how much overall wealth? Talk about the high wage workers and the middle wage and low wage. How much wealth compared to how much wealth is ensconced in rents and capital? That's where the real inequality is.
Yeah.
The rich getting richer, it's not, those are not the rich people.
Yeah.
The rich people are the people who own capital, either in terms of hard assets or financial assets.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with that.
Yeah. Yeah. This you're right. This is income.
This is income.
This is measuring inequality based on income, right. Not on wealth, which is a very, very different,
right.
Very, very different thing. Yeah.
So you're going there?
No, we can. I wasn't going to, but
we
can go anywhere you want. This is Holden, yeah.
Choose your adventure.
Yeah. There's no test. We can talk about whatever you want.
No syllabus.
Yeah. But I think that's a really important point. You know, how you, again, it goes back to my original question. By what metric are you going to use to measure inequality and growing I should have asked this up front and I forgot to. Is the world becoming more or less equal?
Less.
Hmm. Well,
in terms of
income
or wealth?
Both. I think the trends are the same direction.
More.
The world is becoming more equal.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is growing inequality within countries.
Yes. Right?
There's shrinking inequality across countries.
Yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, growing wealth and growing income in places like India and China, you know, Vietnam, places like that are bringing inequality across the globe to the lowest levels in our history, probably, you know, before the Industrial Revolution. But within countries, it's growing. And this, I think, it helps explain part of why that is.
I have to add one thing. I had to laugh at what I was seeing. I was in China, heading to northern China in the wintertime, and these people were living in these small huts, and they had metal roofs on their on their buildings, on their house, and they were holding them down with tires and bricks. But up above that was a satellite dish on that side. And I'd go another mile and I'd see another one and I'd say, by golly, you know, they want to know what's going on out there in the world. They don't care about the roof.
Well, we're getting a little short in time, so I want to let me throw out a question that maybe will sort of tie things together and let us address some of the questions that are floating around up there. So if I'm hearing you correctly, and I realize I'm generalizing a little bit, so inequality exists. It's, some of us think it's sort of a problem. It appears that at least our current system of capitalism, at least if it doesn't fully cause it, at least contributes to growing inequality. What should we do about it? This is what I think is the most interesting part of this, right? So, I mean, identify the problem, figure out what's the nature of that problem, and now, what do you do about it? Because I think when you start asking those questions, the rubber hits the road, and you're like, okay, there are some serious trade-offs here. We could reduce inequality, but there's a cost to that. And I find it really interesting to sort of to mess with those questions. And so I would be interested in hearing some of your ideas about what, from a policy standpoint, should we or could we do?
It disturbs
me. Or whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, yeah.
It disturbs me that the lack of concern for common good in this country, that seems to be diminishing. I take care of my own, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. That there is not as there seems to be less and less concern for the community as a whole. Like you're saying, in terms of public health and communal concern, working together, I don't know, that's what I would hope in some way could be blended into our economic concern.
And then I shouldn't self-promote, but that Friday, that's the topic. That's what I want to spend my time on. I agree with you. I think it's really important and really tricky.
Well, a couple of things. So I want to understand more about market socialism and capitalism, but like I'm choosing now to go to a co-op grocery store because the idea that workers who work their benefit and reap the benefits of when, you know, the store does well and they'd have more incentive to work harder. And I would, anytime there's a co-op, I want to send my business there. And if that becomes more of an ethic and people can grow more co-ops, banking with public banks, why our cities and states don't park our money in public banks instead of private banks. I used to work for Saul Price, who was a socialist, and he started the Price Club, and his understudies were Sam Walton, who started Walmart, and the Costco guy, and he started the Price Club thinking that it would be this way to get discounts to large institutions like schools and stuff, and he was really sad to see sort of what happened with the big box store model, and he always would say, tax me. He would go to his politicians and say, tax me, I'm begging you, ethically, I shouldn't have this much. So, I don't know, higher taxes, more co-ops, public banking.
Yeah, so there are a couple of interesting things in there that I'll sort of highlight. So one option is that we could change laws to promote different forms of firm organization, right? I said one of the three big institutions in capitalism is that firms produce things, right? And there's nothing, you know, the nature of a corporation is not something, it's not part of natural law, right? We define it. We have a choice about what a corporation looks like, and we say that the responsibility is to the shareholders. I mean, it doesn't have to be that way. We can change things, and you know, cooperatives might be one way to do that. I have a love-hate relationship with cooperatives, actually, because, you know, I mean, when they're really successful, they tend to lose their nature. REI doesn't seem like a co-op to me, although I love REI. It doesn't seem like a co-op, right? So that's one piece. The second thing is, you talk about high taxes. And so redistribution is an obvious possible solution. Another way to measure inequality is not, rather than income, would be post-distribution income. So, you know, take away taxes, add, you know, programs for the poor, and add those in, and then inequality tends to shrink. But you know, Scandinavian countries do much more of that, and they have much less inequality than we do. So that's an option. Okay, good.
One of the things that, you know, Warren Buffett, who's one of the richest guys in the world, describes is taxing capital, return on capital at least as much as you tax return on labor. The sainted Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, reduced taxes generally across the board, but raised taxes on capital gains and dividends, and the rate on both was 28%. We have a system where labor is taxed in general at higher rates than dividends and capital gains. And you know, I haven't gotten all the way through it yet because it's pretty complicated. But Thomas Piketty's book that came out a couple of years ago.
That book is
R is greater than G is the basic premise of that. The return on capital in industrialized countries is always going to be greater than the growth rate of the economy. So if you have capital, you are by definition, those who own capital are going to continue to get wealthier than those who don't have capital. Because the rate of growth in the economy is basically a ceiling on essentially labor value growth, if I'm summarizing that correctly. But taxing return on capital at the same rate, at least the same rate, as you're taxing income from labor, seems to me to be one basic attainable objective from a policy perspective. Mm-hmm. you know, getting rid of corporations, turning the whole world into a big co-op, that kind of stuff, you know, is just not going to happen. So we can talk about it if we want, but it's not going to happen. But policy-wise, our tax system favors those with capital, by far.
So what we tax might matter a lot.
The difference between the two workers you were talking about, you know, one was a high school educated, and one I assume had some more advanced education. I think access to education is the number one thing for individuals to, you know, to be able to rise out of inequality, to rise out of where they are.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what, you know, what makes someone a complement to new technology? It's probably education, right? And there's a big, strong correlation between, you know, between this and this. So how do you do that?
Well, you talk about policy, you talked about things of that nature. Like, for instance, I'm from Wenatchee, and we're fruit growers. And a lot of fruit growers, there's a very large group that have put together scholarship funds for students that are farm worker students. And there are literally millions of dollars going into this. And so many, many students are now getting, they're the first students in their families to ever get a college education, I mean, many of them. Huge opportunity. And you've worked out deals with Central Washington University and others to, you know, to reduce tuition. And so there's access to opportunity that they have. You know, whether they take the choice or not is another matter, but at least the opportunity's there.
Yeah, and so, you know, opportunity or educational opportunities is an interesting one too, because I think one's educational opportunities is driven largely by one's parents' education. Right, and so it's the kind of thing that perpetuates itself generation after generation. Breaking that cycle might be one of the keys.
Case in point of like hillbilly elegy. You can kind of get out and get educated, but that's not the culture of a lot of people. I mean, we find ourselves now. This room is rather one-sided. The thing that's scary is the frustration of the people that aren't here, that have been left out for so long and are not going for any of this anymore and are only for what's happening in the government today and won't accept any other truths that are trying to counteract what's happening in our government right now. They're so frustrated they're not thinking the way this room is thinking.
Well, speaking of government, California government is now offering college education through community college for free. You don't need, thank you for doing what you're doing, but the state has made the decision to make community college through 2 years free. It is doable.
Yeah. It's a form of redistribution, right? Right. How does that get paid for? It's from taxing somebody.
And of course, everybody makes fun of California, high taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, we're investing that money. We also happen to have a budget surplus.
50 to 60% of our society has trouble coming up with $1,000 to $2,000. You know, I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal. They were saying, "Golly sake, where's that 50-60% of our population? They're not with us anymore. They're just not. We're leaving them behind. They're still at the train station. They're not on the train yet." And I don't know how you put everybody back on the train, but we've lost a lot of them.
That's the policy question.
Yeah.
I think we'll go back here for a while. I don't know if it's been mentioned, but I think estate taxation would make a big difference when you have persistent inequality across generations. It often comes from, well, being passed down from generation to generation, and that puts an unfair advantage, I think, on the children. They didn't do anything to earn it, and they have all this capital. So when you're taxing capital and stuff like that, you're kind of maybe tapping the brakes on economic activity, or you're redistributing investments that might need to go to certain places. But it seems more like you're taxing between generations, you know, and that just handing out bags of cash for the next generation and nothing to earn it. Might be a way
to address the problem itself.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Again, it goes to that question of what do you tax on estate taxes.
That essentially gets you more towards the idea of universal basic income.
Yeah, exactly.
If you look at your hypothetical manufacturing worker, are they doing that because that is the only thing that is available to them, or is it because that is something that they want to do? And having freedom to make that choice could be one way of saying, okay, well, you may be doing that because that's what you want to do. Or alternatively, could you take those skills and, you know, if you were being, say, a machinist on your own, we have a shortage of those, and we need more of those people, and if you had that freedom to grow that, then that would be a benefit for everybody, yourself included.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I actually was going to ask you about universal basic income and what you think as an economist. A lot of books have recently been written and people are talking about it as a form of redistribution. What's your perspective as an economist?
I haven't studied it a lot. Huh?
Didn't one of the Scandinavian countries just like do a pilot?
Finland.
Yeah.
Somebody tried a little trial, and I don't think it went very well.
Yeah, that was my perception.
From what I've heard.
Which is not what I wanted to hear.
I don't know. I mean, it's probably ultimately an empirical question, and I think doing these sorts of trials is probably the best way to do it. I mean, it would certainly help inequality, right? It would free up people sort of on the lower income levels, free them up for education and things like that. I mean, it gets you out of these poverty traps, I think, which is probably really good. There are concerns about incentives. The evidence on that is a little mixed, I think. So I don't know, man, the honest answer. I just don't know. But I do think it's an interesting enough idea that these sorts of trials and experiments are probably worthwhile. But it's certainly a way to.
I think we just have to show off these people a little more. The entrepreneurs that are making money, they're going to have to go into the school system, the public school system, and show off a little bit and tell them how they made their money. Not listen to the teacher. Let capitalism into our school system. And show them that, hey, you know, if you work hard, this is what's going to happen. You're going to make some money, and you're going to create something. That's capitalism. We have to have more capitalism in our public school system so that they catch on. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to respond to that because the best educational program that I've seen in the country, and I had to do a study that sort of brings in businesses to the schools. It's you can look it up. It's called the Big Picture Company, and kids starting in middle school have to do internships based on their passions or apprenticeships with mentors out in the community. And in high school, they only spend 3 days of school in school. They're actually out studying whatever they want to study with work mentors, and they do phenomenal work. They get into work because you have to show people at a young age. We don't have guilds anymore. We don't have these things. Right. What does it look like to be a working person, and how do you make communications? How do you, you know, get around town? And it's just a really neat program that they have. Anywhere can start one of these big picture learning schools. They co-locate on community college campuses, so the high school students are taking college classes while they're in high school, and they're basically out doing internships and meeting the standards at the same time. It's really terrific. I just wanted to say, you know, maybe this is unrealistic, but social movements too, if young people today, if it became cool or in the fashion to, you know, to study ecology, to learn how to build your own homes, to become more sort of makers of things, as opposed to just accruers of, you know, wealth, that could maybe shift equality a bit.
Culture shouldn't be ignored, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to ask millennials. We're talking about an antiquated system compared to what the millennials think they're doing with the world, and they're next.
Right.
And I feel like a lot of this isn't going to be relevant.
I want to follow up on what Courtney just pointed out. I was involved 5 years ago in an organization called Startup Weekend. 20-somethings build businesses in a weekend to get funded. one of the larger movements out there. There are 10,000 or so companies created every year through this organization worldwide. And I was astonished at the thinking of these young people. They understood, for example, I don't make money in my business unless I'm making customers happy, something that I didn't get exposed to in business school until almost 40. There is a young generation out there that understands this stuff way better than our generation did. And so that was my personal experience. And then while I was doing that, an article came out in Forbes that identified that 30% of people under 30 years old work in a business they created. Part of that is because most four-year college programs now have a required class on entrepreneurship, and they write a business plan in that college. So there's great hope out there. That generation astonishes me. Having said that, I spent a great time as an educator, and I encountered people who can't be educated. I couldn't identify what it was they were missing. Is it the abstractness of education that some people can't grasp? This is now going to be a disenfranchised group, is my concern. There was actually a report that came out of the Obama administration expressing concern about this, and they estimated between 300,000 and 500,000 people. And they were correlating it to the growth in technology, that there are some people who, you know, whatever their background is, they didn't have the capacity to grasp it.
I hadn't seen that. I found it very interesting. We're getting close to the dinner bell, so we'll take a couple more comments.
About the people that you're talking about who can't learn, and I'm not sure that it's true that they can't learn, but when you talk about college and you talk about people starting their own businesses, and those are people who come from families that they already have some kind of foundation or support, that learning and education and feeling safe to try something and fail and try again and then succeed, that you learn that as a very, very, very young child in the first few years of life, whether it's safe to venture into the world or not based on the home that you come from. And sometimes homes are very chaotic. And when we're talking about inequality, there's this cycle of poverty that a person can get caught up in by no fault of their own, but just simply the what they have been born into. And if dad's in jail and mom is working on fighting her addiction and putting a roof over your head, there's a lot of chaos in your home, and you don't know if she's gonna love you today or if she's gonna be so stressed out that she screams at you today. So you're not gonna feel safe as a child or a young adult trying new things, because the world is not a safe place from the very beginning. So I think it's great that there's all these ideas and that people are trying to start businesses and free college, but there will always be inequality unless we help really young families learn how to provide that safe foundation for their infants.
I can just keep thinking about what someone said earlier on about like what framework we're approaching these conversations with. And if the framework is one of deficit, that there isn't enough, it's a really different place than coming from a place of either there is enough or abundance, or looking for people's strengths. And so I think my question is, when we're talking about people who are having challenges in our school to reach the standards that we're setting for them, or people who are having a hard time, you know, keeping a job or how, you know, housing secure, like instead of looking at the deficit, how can we instead reframe the way that we're talking about people to look for the strengths that everyone has and where we can build on strengths and look for those rather than, and again, this idea of equality is what's the norm that we're saying people are below or above? And I just question the framework that we start from around some of these
around
these
conversations.
Yeah, that's good. You get the last word. I don't really want to end it on this. Don't end it on this. When you're talking about that group of people that can't learn, and it's a hard thing to talk about. I'm a special ed teacher, and I was sort of charged with that group, and I changed from being a special ed teacher to an environmental health advocate because I learned that most of my students had been poisoned by lead and other neurotoxic chemicals that actually made it hard for them to learn. And that could have been stopped really early on in utero and after. And I do think one thing we don't, when we look at that group of people that can't learn, if you look at prisoners and you study their teeth and you look at the buildup of lead and other neurotoxic chemicals in their teeth, it's really high. I mean, there's some kids that are just predisposed to not being able to learn and work and get along because they've had these exposures really on, and that's a public health choice that we could solve now in Flint or anywhere by fixing water and basic things.
But to wrap up, I mean, you know, the problems you're describing there are not wealthy people problems. And so it sort of gets back to this question of, you know, is income a good enough proxy for this? I mean, how many of these problems get solved by increasing wealth, increasing income? It's that, these are really hard questions, right? So it gets back to this point, capitalism is good and it's bad. And I think conversations about rethinking our frameworks and rethinking our institutions it's a better way of looking at this problem rather than just saying we need to let markets be free or we need to restrict markets, right? It's more nuanced, more complicated. Hope the conversation continues. I'll hang out and talk to anybody who wants to. But tomorrow I'll talk about the environment. Friday's on community if you're interested in this. Thanks for coming.